Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Maori Party,
2 in favour.
United Future,
1 in favour.
Once again, the bubble and the spirit level of this 51st Parliament swings back across the chamber as the Maori Party and United Future's Peter Dunn add their 3 votes to take the opposition's tally to 61, a bare majority, but enough to defeat the 60 votes of National and ACT and send Labour's Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill off to a select committee. Now, in the name of Labour's leader, Andrew Little, this member's bill has had a bumpy ride in its progress towards a first reading on Wednesday night, highlighting how finely balanced this parliament is when the government's ministers hand the chamber over to backbenchers on members' days, as Rhys Lyon explains.
Originally introduced by Labour's Phil Twyford back in March of last year, the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill aimed to set standards for insulation and heating in rental homes. Debate on the bill's first reading ended in a dead heat of 60 votes to 60, with Labour, the Greens, New Zealand First, the Māori Party and United Future in favour and National and ACT opposed. The 60-60 draw meant the bill did not proceed, but a second bill, this time in the name of Labour's leader, Andrew Little, was drawn from the ballot last October, by which time the opposition's ability to cobble together a majority had been restored by the election of New Zealand First leader Winston Peters as the new member for Northland. However, Mr. Little's bill, essentially the same as Mr. Twyford's but with a number 2 added to its title, ran into trouble with the Speaker, David Carter, who ruled it not sufficiently different to get around a rule preventing defeated bills coming up again in the same calendar year. As it happened, Andrew Little's Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill number 2 didn't come up for debate last year, but did on Wednesday night. In launching the first reading of the bill, Mr. Little outlined its aim.
The principle that sits behind this bill is a pretty simple one, that no New Zealander, adult or child, should have to live in a house that makes them or their children sick. It's that simple. Every Kiwi kid deserves to grow up in a home that is warm, safe and dry. As parents, and as a parent myself, I wouldn't accept anything less for my own child. It sets standards for rental housing, or private rental housing, and in fact public rental housing too. The bill would require MB to set standards for heating and insulation. And the standards will have to describe what constitutes adequate methods of heating, adequate methods of insulation, adequate indoor temperatures, adequate ventilation, adequate draft stopping and adequate drainage. Mr. Speaker, I make those points to be very clear because some of the objections that have been registered by the government, or at least its Minister of Building and Housing in the last 24 hours, have misled New Zealanders about, in fact, what the bill does.
Q Building and Housing Minister Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, the problem with Mr. Little's bill is firstly, it would have New Zealand homes insulated at a far slower rate than the government's policy. Secondly, that it lacks the details and does not match up to the exaggerated rhetoric that we've just heard from Mr. Little. And thirdly, its impractical provisions will not work in practice. The bill is a poor substitute for the robust and practical measures this government is taking to make our homes in New Zealand warmer, drier and safer. Now, Mr. Speaker, there is no disagreement in this Parliament that making our homes warmer and drier provides substantive benefits for children's health, for reducing days lost at school, for workers being able to stay at home and savings in families' energy bills. It is these very reasons that the government has had such an active program addressing insulation in homes. Mr. Little and Labour are Johnny come lately on this issue when you look at the record. We insulated 30,000 state homes in our first 2 years. In our first budget, we announced a program, Warm Up New Zealand, to to insulate 290,000 homes. The bill we currently have in its final stages would insulate another 180,000 houses. That is 500,000. That 500,000 compares with 50,000 under the last 9 years of the government. It is absolutely true that this government has done 10 times more in respect of getting homes insulated.
Back on the Labour benches, though, Phil Twyford was unconvinced.
This morning's New Zealand Herald commented in its editorial that Nick Smith's bill, which is the counterpart to the bill we're debating tonight, the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill, was a grudging half-measure and introduced as a sop to public opinion. Now, tonight, the Parliament has the opportunity to do the job properly. New Zealand is ready to bring our rental housing into the 21st century. It's no longer good enough in this country of ours that 42,000, in fact, the latest figures indicate, 50,000 preventable hospitalisations of children with respiratory and infectious diseases. Most of those are directly attributable to poverty, cold, damp and mouldy housing. Now, I want to start, Mr Speaker, by quoting the Children's Commissioner, Dr Russell Wills, who told the Parliament that National's bill, he said, is shameful and a wasted opportunity, a broken promise to our children that will do little for children living in cold, damp, mouldy housing. And the Minister should be paying attention to the fact that the Child Poverty Action Group, which has been one of the most dedicated and tireless groups campaigning on this issue, have come out enthusiastically in support of Andrew Little's bill. Nick Smith's been going around the country saying that Andrew Little's bill will add unsupportable costs to landlords and drive up rents. That is absolute rubbish. A heat pump that Nick Smith's bill won't require rental housing, but Andrew Little's bill will cost a landlord $2,000. That cost will last a lifetime of, let's say, 15 years for an asset that will generate hundreds of thousands of dollars of revenue for that landlord. But more importantly, Dr. Smith, for that small investment, it will save lives and prevent unnecessary hospitalisations. And that minister knows, when we're talking about cost-benefit analysis, that $1 invested in retrofitting rental property will save the taxpayer $6 in public health expenditure. Andrew Little's bill is comprehensive. It includes heating. Nick Smith's bill doesn't. It only includes insulation and smoke alarms. Everybody knows, except the minister, that if you insulate a cold house, it's still a cold house. Andrew Little's bill will require, under the standards that will be promulgated under regulations, a modern, affordable and fixed heating source.
Meanwhile, the ACT Party's David Seymour outlined his opposition to the bill.
By bringing a bill that does nothing more than parade faux compassion, offers no real solutions, and leaves the very people it intends to help actually worse off, then we end up in a situation where people lose faith in the political class and hopefully faith in the Labor Party for bringing such a poor solution to the House. And I proudly oppose this bill.
Following Mr Seymour was Greens co-leader Matiria Ture.
I would just like to suggest to the country that you completely ignore everything you heard from the little fellow over there. I am proud to be one of the compassionate and responsible political parties in this House who will be supporting this bill tonight.
The vote on the bill was taken just on 10 p.m. on Wednesday night.
The ayes are 61, the noes are 60. The bill will be read a first time.
Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill number 2, first reading.
The bill passed first reading with the support of Labour, the Greens, New Zealand First, the Māori Party and United Futures' Peter Dunn, and was opposed by National and ACT. And looking ahead to the next Members' Day, scheduled for May the 25th, a similar scenario could await another Labour Party Members' Bill, Sue Moroney's 6 months paid parental leave bill, which passed its first reading last year by that same margin of 61 to 60. Meanwhile, the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill No. 2 has been sent to the Government Administration Committee, which has until November the 4th to report it back to the House.
Rhys Lyon, and he'll be back to report on the week in the committee rooms. While in the chamber, the bubble and the spirit level move back towards the government side the next day, but not all the way. While the Maori Party join National and ACT on Thursday for the third reading of a bill restoring some publicly elected representation to the regional governance of Canterbury's environment, United Futures' Peter Dunn voted with the opposition. Although he didn't speak in the third reading debate, Mr. Dunn tweeted before it began.
I am pleased to be opposing the deferral of the restoration of full democracy to Environment Canterbury legislation this afternoon.
However, when the debate ended just before the adjournment at 6 p.m. on Thursday, National's third whip, Joanne Hayes, added Mr. Dunn's vote to the ayes, only to come back a few minutes later to seek the call from Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard.
Mr. Speaker, this is to correct a vote for the Environment Canterbury Transitional Governance Arrangements Bill. I've just had a call from United Future. They were opposed.
Leavers required of the House for that change to be made, and therefore I will put to the House the question of leave, and that is that United Future be shown as voting against the vote we just had on the Environment Canterbury Bill. Is there any objection to that?
There was none, and so the Environment Canterbury Transitional Governance Arrangements Bill passed its third and final reading by 62 votes to 59, yet another combination of the numbers at the heart of this Parliament. While the combination ensuring that John Key's National-led minority government has money supply and the confidence of the House was fully back on the Treasury benches on Tuesday night. That's when the three minor parties honoured their formal agreements and voted for the Appropriation 2014-15 Confirmation and Validation Bill, given a third reading by 63 votes to 58, ending the 10-hour annual review debate. That was followed by a start on the third reading of tax legislation, which the Inland Revenue Department had been developing since 2013, as revealed in answers to questions earlier on Tuesday, when Labour's Grant Robertson pressed Revenue Minister Michael Woodhouse for the reason that the department had not proceeded with an inquiry into foreign-owned investment trusts.
Inland Revenue list under action plan items review taxation of foreign trusts with a date of December 2014 for that.
The Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Well, yes, Mr. Speaker, it did, and it also included things like strengthening the non-resident withholding tax rules, which would have affected positively the New Zealand tax base, GST on online purchases, which would have positively affected the tax base, and it proceeded with those things because that was good for the New Zealand taxpayer. The other is not and could have been negative.
And later on Tuesday night, Mr. Woodhouse was back in the chamber, leading the third reading debate of the bill that emerged, bringing in a new residential land withholding tax and making way for the collection of GST on online transactions. Meanwhile, in questions to the Prime Minister on Tuesday, Greens co-leader James Shaw tried to find out whether Mr. Key had had anything to do with the decision not to review foreign investment trusts.
So given that it was his own lawyer who asked for and was granted a guarantee that there wouldn't be a review of foreign trust regulation, is he not concerned about the perception that lobbyists can influence government policy on behalf of vested interests in New Zealand?
Mr. Key said that he'd acted strictly by the book.
I did what is the fully and totally appropriate thing. I told the person and their lobby group to go and speak to the minister. That happens every day. And if the member was to ever get into government, is he saying that if Russell Norman ever came up to him and said there was an issue in relation to the environment, he wouldn't tell the person to go and speak to the environment? In New Zealand, we're a small country. People know other people.
And they talked to each other, as Mr. Key's ministers pointed out when ridiculing the opposition's pursuit of the Prime Minister and his lawyer in Wednesday's general debate.
They have worked themselves into this incandescent rage over the totally unacceptable situation that our Prime Minister knows people. My God, he knows people, and sometimes the people he knows actually come and talk to him. What an outrage!
Justice Minister Amy Adams was echoed by her Cabinet colleague Jo Goodhue.
There are members in this House who have worked themselves into a lather about the people the Prime Minister talks to. It's going to be a long lather because the Prime Minister talks to people all the time. In fact, he is regularly mobbed around this country and people want to get into his ear and they want to ask his advice and they want to tell him about the things that are happening in their lives.
The Minister for the Community and Voluntary Sector, Jo Goodhue, speaking in the general debate on Wednesday when the cause of protest marches and demonstrations outside Parliament quietly slipped into the debating chamber.
Select committee reports have been delivered for presentation.
Reports of the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on the International Treaty Examination of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
The reports on the international treaty examinations are set down for consideration.
And as Rhys Lyon reports, the TPPA looks set to divide the House right down the middle when it comes up for debate.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, signed by 12 countries, is a document more than 6,000 pages long, while the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade's national interest analysis on it is more than 270 pages long. The Select Committee's report on its examination of the trade deal, meanwhile, takes up 21 pages. The first part of the report reflects the views of the government majority on the committee, while the views of the opposition parties are included as minority reports. While the committee majority supported the TPPA and sought to allay public concerns about a lack of consultation and transparency on it, the three separate minority reviews from Labour, the Greens and New Zealand First all criticised specific provisions of the bill as well as the process taken in negotiating it. The Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee's report now awaits debate in the chamber. Meanwhile, in the committee rooms this week, two former MPs with opposing views on the government's resource legislation amendment bill made submissions to the Local Government and Environment Committee, as did the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, Jan Wright, who cautioned its extended powers for central government influence in local resource management decisions.
We have a system where there's a balance between devolution to local government and some direction from central government. I'm actually supportive of more central government direction. I think there's far too much of reinventing the wheel that's gone on around the country. But the bill does give significantly greater powers to the minister, and we need checks and balances on those powers. Those greater powers are fine for people when they agree with the minister, when they don't. So this cuts both ways, really, there's greater powers to the minister. Of those new powers, the ones that concern me most are the ones that are very broad and wide-ranging because you don't have any sense of how they could be used. There's also restriction of access to the Environment Court where decisions actually get tested. It's a concern, and the bill also goes too far in restricting who can have their say. And again, that sort of thing goes both ways, whether one is on an environmental side or some other side. So take care in your consideration of the bill. The devil's in the detail, and there's an awful lot of them. Details in this bill.
Concerns with those extended powers were also expressed in another submission from Greater Wellington Regional Council Chairman and former Labour MP Chris Laidlaw.
If there is a single issue which worries us most, it's the myriad of changes in the bill, big and small, which results in ministerial powers tantamount to pre-RMA days when ministers made resource management decisions by regulation. We agree with the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment that it gives the Minister broad powers that rely on a subjective judgment of what is reasonable. Equally significant, it creates a tension between greater reliance on collaborative processes involving the community and ministerial fiat, at a time when we are clearly moving into a new era of community participation in resource management decision-making. My council attaches high importance to this innovation. It's become fundamental to our resource management regime. If the bill is passed in its current form, the Minister will be able to permit or prohibit certain activities, even after a council may have spent years making a plan with their community and having determined that a resource consent should be required for a particular activity. The Minister will be able to specify that certain activities can be consented without public notification and restrict who will be considered an affected party. But the bill does not state which activities this power will relate to or restrict the Minister's ability to use this power. It is, in effect, unbridled. We like the notion of a national planning template in principle, but the projected scope in the bill is so wide that the Minister could not only determine how a plan is laid out, but also impose objectives or policies or rules on communities. When these powers and many others sit with the Minister, it means that they are no longer with the community. The bill reduces local decision-making and the ability for people in the community to participate in resource management processes. The bill, as drafted, will also limit public participation by requiring submissions to be struck out if they're not supported by evidence, and this creates a whole new opportunity for challenge by applicants and submitters for councils to deal with. So, in sum, we suggest that you refer the bill back to the Minister pending the outcome of the comprehensive work by the Productivity Commission and Local Government New Zealand.
But Mr. Laidlaw said the bill wasn't all bad.
There's a lot in this that we welcome. Iwi participation in particular, which we've already built into our planning processes.
Though disagreeing with that sentiment was another past MP, this time former ACT member Stephen Franks, now representing the Taxpayers Union, who suggested iwi had too much power through resource management consultation provisions under the proposed bill.
I'd just summarise by saying that I expected when this stage of RMA reform came through that the government might have reflected on the experience of the 18,000 property owners in Auckland and the clear evidence of abuse of the assessment provisions and the constitutional, the notoriously unclear constitutional position when you inject unelected people into the lawmaking process, because plan writing is lawmaking. Plan writing is quintessentially lawmaking. And when you instruct that possibly the majority, but certainly people holding the balance of power, can be appointed without prescribing ways in which that appointment power is exercised, without requiring it to be democratic, without requiring it to be held on any basis of expertise, without any constraints against corruption, it's pretty hard to then blame the people who exploit it, because we're human, we're all human, and exploitation of power is a universal experience, and it's why constitutional law addresses fairly common issues of the world over. And when we found this bill and looked at what it provided on IPAs and the injection of more automatic lawmaking role for iwi, we were stunned at the primitive nature of the provisions.
Stephen Franks with that submission on the Resource Legislation Amendment Bill, which is due to be reported back to the House by June the 3rd.
That report from Rhys Lyon. In Question Times this week, it was not so much the quality, but feel the length. On Tuesday, it was the length of the questions.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters will immediately leave this chamber. Order!
New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters, following his transport spokesman Dennis O'Rourke out the door after the Speaker, David Carter, lost patience with the length of one of Mr O'Rourke's questions.
The question was so long, it's very easy to remember to address any part of it. The member wants a short, sharp question. I can help him get a straight answer.
Dennis O'Rourke wasn't having that.
The question was not
order,
long,
Mr. Order. Mr. Member will resume his seat immediately. I have ruled. I'm giving the member a chance to complete his questioning. If he doesn't want to, we can easily move to the next one.
But Mr O'Rourke continued to defend the one he'd already asked.
Point of order.
If it's a fresh point of order, I'll hear it. If it's any attempt to relitigate where I've just got to, I'll be asking the member to leave.
Which he was doing within seconds as Dennis O'Rourke continued to argue the toss.
I'm simply asking if that question was too long.
I've dealt with that matter.
What
I'm
is the appropriate
Dennis
length
O'Rourke quit. Dennis O'Rourke will leave the chamber. I gave him an absolute clear warning. Order, the member will leave.
Dennis O'Rourke headed for the exit as his leader took up his case with the Speaker.
Speaker, my colleague asked if the question is too long, then how would you have phrased it? I think that he was seeking some clarity, because if the question was too long, you would have ruled it out at the very start when he finished asking the question. Now, that's why my colleague was a bit...
The member will resume his seat. I have been relatively lenient in light of the way... Order! The member's very likely to be leaving the chamber and joining his colleague.
Mr Carter then reviewed progress so far.
I've been relatively lenient, but when a question was as long as that, it is very difficult for me to actually decipher the specific of the question, and therefore I ruled that the member of the minister had addressed the question. Mr O'Rourke took exception to that. I warned him if he continued to relitigate a decision I've made, then he would be asked to leave the chamber. He then immediately did relitigate the question I'd made.
The Speaker warned Mr Peters that his next point of order better be a fresh one, and the New Zealand First Leader assured him that it would be.
Because it arises from your comment that you've been lenient to New Zealand First in question time today. As a matter of clarification, could you point out on what occasions, at what time, have you been lenient to us?
That is effectively an allegation of bias. Order. And that is a contempt of this House. The Right Honourable Winston Peters will also leave the chamber. The Right Honourable Winston Peters will immediately leave this chamber. Order!
On Thursday, it was the length of the answer.
Order, I know it's Thursday afternoon, but we're still going to get through question time.
But not without more opposition complaints at the length of the answers, this time coming from Labour's David Parker.
Mr Speaker, you often remind us that it is for the Speaker to determine the length of an answer, and that is correct, but it brings disorder when the opposition feels that a different standard is applied to ministers answering questions than opposition members, including Mr Peters, asking them.
Order. The member was right with his first point. It is for me to determine.
And the Speaker agreed with Mr Parker's complaint about the length of Stephen Joyce's answer to a Patsy question about his government's delivery of the Better Public Services programme.
And the answer, I hope, is now concluded, because it was certainly a very long answer.
As was the answer to the next question, another Patsy from National backbencher Alfred Naro.
How are improvements in results in the education sector supporting our young people?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, again, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, a fulsome answer, because education is improving under this government. Spending has increased by $1.8 billion. That has contributed to the outstanding success of Result 5 of Better Public Service Targets, including Trades Academies, the Youth Guarantee Scheme and Māori and Pacifica
order.
Trades
order.
Training.
The Speaker acknowledged another protest from David Parker.
Point of order, the Honourable David.
I make the same point of order, sir.
The Speaker warned David Parker against becoming part of the problem.
To continue to raise points of order like that is in itself creating disorder, Mr Parker.
But David Parker hadn't finished.
Point of order, the order. Honourable David Parker.
Mr Speaker, answers are meant to be concise. When the Minister fills them full of irrelevant superlatives, things that are not facts, but his assertions of how grand he and his government is,
I don't want any further.
Again, Mr Carter said he would decide when an answer went on for too long.
If the member now wants to raise a point of order that doesn't in any way address the matters we've just determined, I'll certainly consider it. But if the member's going to continue to relitigate the decision that I've already made, I will then be asking the member to leave. Does the member have a point of order?
I do, sir, because
point of order, the Honourable David Parker.
Because your answer addressed the length of questions, my second point of order is that they are full of irrelevancies in the answers that don't meet the prescription standing orders that are meant to be about facts, not skiting sort of irrelevant superlatives.
Order. I covered that point as well by saying just because an opposition member doesn't like the answer doesn't mean that I will necessarily curtail it.
There could be no complaints about the length of the answer that Paula Bennett, standing in for Housing Corporation Minister Bill English, gave to this question from his Labour shadow, Phil Twyford.
Is this why the government changed the law to give him extraordinary unfettered powers to sell state houses to anyone he likes on whatever terms he likes, so that he can flog off billions of dollars of state housing to speculators while New Zealanders in need miss out?
The Mr. Honourable Speaker.
Paula Bennett.
No.
Money for your mates.
And there, sadly, we must leave it. I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.